Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. I'd like to call the Senate Committee. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, April 9th, 2018. The time is 9:14 a.m. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Michicki.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens should be joining us shortly, and Senator Olson is excused today. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. On today's agenda, we have HB 273, the extension for Marijuana Control Board, HB 278, extension for Certified Real Estate Appraiser Board, HB 279, extension of the Real Estate Commission, SB 38, Pharmaceutical Benefit Managers, and SB 185, Reemployment of Retired Teachers and Administration. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? I'd like to call the committee's attention first to HB 273, an act extending the termination date of the Marijuana Control Board and providing for an effective date. Senate Finance heard this bill on April 3, 2018. We reviewed the fiscal note, and the public hearing was open and closed. I'd like to invite Representative Keto to the microphone with his staff, Crystal Kieneman. Representative Keto, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Sam Keto III, Representative, House District 33. And thank you for hearing House Bill 279.
Are there questions from committee members? Are we ready to move the bill? Senator Bishop, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 273, version 30-LS1183/David from committee with the accompanying fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 273 moves from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations. Brief at ease. While we sign the paperwork, I would like to acknowledge Senator Stevens has arrived.
Thank
Welcome.
You, Madam Chair.
We're back on the record. I'd like to direct the Senate's attention to House Bill 278, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers and providing for an effective date. A brief history on the bill. On April 3, 2018, Senate Finance heard the bill. We reviewed the fiscal notes. The public hearing was open and closed. I'd like to invite Representative Josephson. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. We've been joined by Megan Holland, staff, to represent Josephson. Are there questions on the bill before us?
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
I would like to, I don't know if you have the department, Ms. Chambers.
Ms. Chambers, if you could join us at the microphone. Ms. Chambers, Senator Machicki, do you have a question?
I actually have three quick ones for the record, Madam Chair.
Please.
I'm focused on the fee analysis, the chain of custody issues, and Ms. Berlini's complaint. Could you first, why is the fee analysis higher than the board's?
For the record, this is Sarah Chambers with the Department of Commerce. Senator Marchicki, I apologize. I was confirming that we were on real estate appraisers and not real estate commission, so I missed part of your question. Would you mind asking it again?
Actually, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. If we're on real estate appraisers, I will save my question for...
We are on real estate appraisers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize.
Is there other questions? Seeing hearing none, Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 278, version 30-LS1160, /David from committee with the accompanying fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 278, an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers and providing for an effective date, moves from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. We're back on the record. The next item before Senate Finance is House Bill 279, an act extending the termination date of the Real Estate Commission and providing for an effective date. Brief history on the bill. The bill was heard on April 3rd, 2018. We reviewed the fiscal notes. The public hearing was open and closed. I'd like to invite Representative Josephson to the microphone, as well as his staff, Megan Holland. Senator Michicki, you had a question. We may need a third chair at the microphones for Ms. Chambers.
Yes. Ms. Chambers.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Representative Josephson, do you have some comments for us on the bill before us?
Good morning, Madam Chair. I really don't. I think that my memory is that the Labor and Commerce Committee did its due diligence, heard from the Audit Division, and made the recommendation to extend the commission.
Thank you. Senator Michicki had a question. Senator Michicki.
I did, and more specifically on the first question, was the division's proposal being higher than the board's? Your explanation doesn't give detail about why you decided to agree. Can you explain that a little better instead of just that you sort of agreed to disagree? How did you come to the conclusion that the board's numbers were adequate?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Sarah Chambers, Department of Commerce. Through the Chair, Senator Michicki, the statute AS080165 requires the division and the board to work together. I think the wording is to consult with the board and make sure that those decisions aren't made independently. And so we do that regularly every time we have a fee analysis. The board offered observations that had not been taken into consideration with the fee analysis, the desire to reduce the surplus being one, and the director opted to take the board's recommendation as opposed to the analysis that she had performed. That's not unusual, and it is a sign of the healthy process.
Senator Michicki.
And I'll skip the second one, wait till that board, that bill is up. But on 279, on Ms. Berlini's complaint, you did answer that you expect, I'll let you answer that. But so in our decision that the board is functional in serving the public purpose, I was at least aware of a case. It would be nice to get some clarity about whether the public's was best served in that particular case. So can you talk about what's happening with that investigation, please?
Yes, through the Chair, Senator Michicki, I'll give you some overview, and then we do have Chief Investigator Greg Francois, who's in charge of our investigations unit, available for questions as well. This complaint came in, and our investigator for this program reviewed the facts that had been provided by Ms. Berlini and determined that it was non-jurisdictional. So the senior investigator reviewed it and did so agreed as well. Since the questions have come up with concerns, particularly in this committee, we have reopened the investigation with a commitment to complete the investigation if all parties provide us with the information that we need timely within 30 days. We will keep Ms. Berlini informed of the steps and the outcome of the investigation, and we have been in contact with the Department of Law to assist to use this as an opportunity to double-check whether processes worked or whether there is a need for any change in our systems.
That's perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Chambers, did you want Greg to be able to speak to the issue?
He's available if there are additional detailed questions.
Additional questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Chambers.
Thank you.
Senator Bishop, may I have a motion?
Madam Chair, thank you. I move House Bill 279, version 30, LS 1161, / David from committee with the accompanying fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 279, an act extending the termination date of the Real Estate Commission and providing for an effective date, moves from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations. Representative Josephson, thank you for joining us this morning. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. We're back on the record. The next item before the Senate Finance Committee is SB 38, an act relating to the registration and duties of pharmacy benefit managers relating to procedures, guidelines, and enforcement mechanisms for pharmacy audits relating to the cost of multi-source generic drug and insurance reimbursement procedures relating to the duties of the Director of the Division of Insurance and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Senator Giesel and her staff, Jane Conway, to the microphone to introduce the bill. This is a courtesy hearing so that all senators have a preview of what this bill is intended to accomplish for the people of Alaska. We will not be taking public hearing today on this bill. We do have two individuals that Senator Giesel has asked to speak on some of the components of the bill, but again, no public hearing today on SB 38. We will not be reviewing the fiscal notes, and we will be holding this bill. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N. And, Madam Chair, I don't commonly add this, but I'm going to today. I am also a licensed primary care clinician in the state of Alaska for nearly 20 years. Thank you to the committee for hearing this bill today. Madam Chair, as a reminder, Alaska has the highest health care costs in the United States. The United States has the highest health care costs in the world. Today, in a major healthcare journal, those facts were substantiated. Further, Madam Chair, that journal pointed out that it is not utilization that drives the cost of healthcare in the United States, but actually the cost of that healthcare. Madam Chair, pharmaceutical costs make up about 20% of healthcare costs. Administrative costs are another huge piece of it. This bill addresses both of those items. Madam Chair, it is imperative that Alaska seize the day and address these costs. Madam Chair, SB 38 is fundamentally a consumer protection bill. Pharmacy benefit managers serve as middlemen for plans, health insurance plans, between pharmaceutical manufacturers and retailers or pharmacies. PBMs are designed to perform administrative duties for insurers, validate patient eligibility, administer plan benefits, and negotiate costs between pharmacies and healthcare plans. They also audit for fraud. By creating networks of multiple pharmacies, PBMs have leveraged their size and power to negotiate contracts between drug manufacturers and retail outlets, those being the pharmacies. They can secure rebates or kickbacks on certain drugs and are responsible for determining which drugs are covered by different health care plans. Over the years, the pharmacy benefit manager market has become highly consolidated. Their focus seems to be less about serving consumers and more about increasing company profits. Egregious and anti-competitive behavior on the part of major PBMs have harmed consumers with increased costs, as well as community pharmacists with their often unreasonable business practices. Madam Chair, respecting the time of the committee, I'm going to turn this now over to my staff, Jane Conway, who will take you through a review of the subject and the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Conway, for clarity, after you introduce yourself for the record, are we going to be walking through a specific sectional analysis on the function of the bill, or is this an overview on what the bill is, bill and PBMs do, or both?
For the record, my name is Jane Conway, staff to Senator Kathy Geisel, and our intention is to just, do the PowerPoint and do an overview of what the bill is about.
Thank you. Please continue.
Senate Bill 38 is a consumer protection bill. Shines a light on PBM opaque auditing and MAC practices to help drive prescription costs down. It is a small business protection bill. Components of this bill help ensure the financial viability of critical small-town Alaska pharmacies and access to health care for their consumers. The short title of the bill is Pharmacy Benefit Managers. The bill is about pharmacists, insurers, health plans, but also about the role of PBMs, which is an entity most people do not know much about. PBMs are multi-billion dollar middlemen entities. Started in 1970s, they began as claim processors, but today are now intertwined in almost every aspect of the pharmaceutical and pharmacy supply chain. They are virtually unregulated at the state or federal level. And today, the top PBMs represent some of the most profitable companies in the nation. Here's a couple of the companies that I'm sure you have seen before, CVS Caremark, and by the way, that's the state's plan pharmacy benefit manager. In 2017, they were the seventh most profitable U.S. company in the Fortune 500 list, and their revenue in 2017 was $177.5 billion. Express Scripts generated $100.3 billion in revenue in 2017, and they came in as the number 22 ranking. Here's a picture of something we all have in our wallets. Our State of Alaska Healthcare Plan card, and as you see, Aetna is the healthcare plan, and they contract out with CVS Caremark to handle the prescriptions. PBMs were designed to reduce administrative costs, validate eligibility, administer plan benefits, negotiate costs between pharmacies and health plans, and audit pharmacies for fraud. PBMs develop pharmacy provider networks with contracts, and in all reality, pharmacies must accept a PBM contract. They will either sign the contract, or if they don't sign it, they will lose all the customers covered by that plan. So it is really kind of a no-win situation for them if they want the business. They influence what drugs are dispensed by using a list of PBM-approved drugs known as formularies. PBMs receive rebates or kickbacks from drug manufacturers for putting those drugs on a given formulary and a MAC list. They dictate how much pharmacies will be paid for the drugs they dispense, regardless of what it costs the pharmacy to acquire that drug. They have free rein to dictate what pharmacies are permitted to do in a given network, thereby driving patients to particular pharmacy options. An example of that is they will also often incentivize customers to go to their mail order pharmacies in direct competition with the pharmacy who is dispensing the drug. This slide has a lot of information on it. This is the slide that keeps me awake at night when I try to figure out how to paraphrase this into the simplest form possible. But in this scenario, there are three things that go on in terms of these transactions. So we're going to do just a little step-by-step by talking about how one drug is priced out. So you have the insurer or the payer or the plan, and let's say they arrive at a $100 price for a certain given drug, and they agree to that in their contract plan, that the plan will cover this drug for $100. Meanwhile, over in the middle, the PBM then negotiates that $100 price with the pharmaceutical company. And I just to, on a side note, let's pretend it's a CVS Caremark. They have a lot of power and clout to negotiate these prices because they manage 70 million prescriptions across the country. So they have the $100 price. However, the drug company will give a rebate to the PBM for $50. So then, essentially, the $50 is what the PBM is going to pay the pharmacist when he dispenses that drug. But meanwhile, over here on the right side, you have the pharmacy. And the pharmacy needs to go out and shop for the best price that they can get for this particular drug. And the best price they find out that they can get for that drug is $60. So when that pharmacy dispenses that drug, it's a $60 drug. They are reimbursed for $50, thereby losing $10 on that prescription the moment they dispense it. And a $10 spread oftentimes is a nominal discrepancy. Sometimes these discrepancies can be upwards to $50, $60, $70 per prescription of under reimbursement. PBMs would suggest that this bill would have an increase in costs to the payers when, in fact, a payer has paid more for the actual cost of the drug to begin with due to the kickbacks or rebates the PBM receives. The actual effect, in all reality, would be the lowering of the PBM's profit margin. You will hear that from PBMs that no other state has this kind of legislation. So we reached out to the National Academy of State Health Policy, and we found out that 80 pieces of legislation currently introduced in legislatures across the country, they have been introduced to regulate PBM practices, and even the White House is now paying attention to PBM practices. The fair audit provisions of 38 are consistent with legislation in other states, and the requirements for setting pharmacy drug reimbursement rates, including appeals, are also similar in other states. Here's a visual. In blue, these are the states that have enacted fair pharmacy audit legislation. And you can see Alaska is one of the few that has not. Here's another map. These states in the blue dots have enacted generic drug pricing transparency, the MAC list, which I will address momentarily. And again, we are in the minority here. So what is this MAC? What is MAC? What is maximum allowable cost? It refers to a payer or PBM generated list of products that include the upper limit or maximum amount that a plan will pay for a generic drug or brand name drug that has a generic version, which we call multi-source brands. A PBM may have several MAC lists depending on the plan. Essentially, no two MAC lists are alike, and each PBM has free rein to pick and choose products for their MAC lists. Sometimes the MAC list is confused with the term formulary. A formulary is a list of all the drugs that are covered by a particular insurance plan. Generally, it has no pricing attached to it, and it will contain both brand name drugs and generic drugs. Because of this lack of clarity and complexity of the issues surrounding PBMs, they can use their MAC list to generate significant revenue. Typically, they utilize an aggressively low MAC price for reimbursing and a different higher list of prices when they negotiate prices with their clients or plans. Essentially, they reimburse low and charge high, pocketing the often significant spread between the two prices. And most plan sponsors are unaware that multiple MAC lists do exist and are being used and have no real understanding of how much revenue the PBM retains. When the PBM fails to update a MAC list in a timely fashion, which is often the case, sometimes, you know, it can be 1 month or several months, pharmacies are often forced to dispense at a loss, which I had tried to describe earlier, sometimes as high as $100 or more on a single prescription, or they will choose not to dispense it at all. The MAC list can be updated at any time and usually decreased, so real-time prices are often obsolete and less than what a pharmacist has expected. When the price increases, PBMs often wait weeks or months before updating their MAC list, and rarely, if ever, do they reimburse a pharmacy retroactively. Yet the PBM acts swiftly to update a MAC list when drug costs decrease. This significantly jeopardizes the financial viability of a community pharmacy. In fact, 84% of pharmacists said the acquisition price spike and lagging reimbursement trends is a very significant impact on their ability to stay in business and continue serving patients. So MAC pricing legislation was designed to provide clarity to plan sponsors and pharmacies with regard to how MAC pricing is determined. It establishes an appeals process by which a dispensing pharmacist can contest a price, and standardization for how products are selected for inclusion on a MAC list. The MAC process currently provides no transparency for plan sponsors or contracted retail network pharmacies, who are, again, required to blindly agree to the PBM contracts. I have realized this slide is rather redundant. I'm going to skip over it. So, Senate Bill 38. What do the MAC transparency components of the bill do? They set reasonable standards. It requires regular reporting of the MAC list prices to a pharmacy in a usable format. It provides a defined MAC appeals process. What it does not do is mandate that a PBM reimburse a pharmacy at a higher amount. It is not an administrative burden on the PBM. It does not mandate that a PBM approve a pharmacy's appeal. And it does not result in increased costs to the healthcare system. There is no documented evidence or analysis nationally that says that MAC pricing legislation has increased healthcare costs. The second component to Senate Bill 38 are the fair audit provisions. Those components bring fairness to the unregulated and expanding practice of pharmacy audits. One of the components is that it does not allow an audit during the first 7 days of each month because of their high patient volume, unless the pharmacy and auditor agree otherwise in advance. It prevents the targeting of minor clerical or administrative errors where there is no fraud, patient harm, or financial loss has occurred. It establishes submission of data and medical record standards to allow for clarification when there are discrepancies, and it establishes a reasonable time frame for the announcement of an audit to allow for proper retrieval of records that would be under review, just like an IRS audit would be. It establishes an audit appeals process for pharmacies and guidelines for PBMs to follow regarding patient confidentiality. The fair audit legislation prohibits extrapolation in assessing fees and penalties. And this is probably the most important component to our local pharmacies, is that it allows Alaska pharmacists to provide mail order service to their customers without being penalized. This legislation does not prevent the recruitment of funds where fraud, waste, or abuse exist. In summary, 40 states have enacted fair audit legislation. 34 states have enacted maximum allowable cost, or MAC, transparency legislation. The bill would also include registration of PBMs as third-party administrators with the State of Alaska Division of Insurance. 13 states use this model with the Division of Insurance. It sets up guidelines for MAC pricing by PBMs and establishes a mechanism for a pharmacy to appeal a MAC pricing denial. Madam Chair and members of the committee, this legislation has been the Alaska Pharmacist Association's number one priority bill for the past 10 years. It was first sponsored by Senator Kim Elton, beginning in 2010. That was taken up later on by Senator Dennis Egan, and now with Senator Giesel. In your packets, you will see numerous articles. Those are just the tip of the iceberg. I have binders filled with articles on this topic. Nationally, the opaque black box practices of PBMs are now under intense scrutiny. All you need to do is Google Pharmacy Benefit Manager, and you will see countless articles on this emerging concern. NCSL is now even tracking these trends. And in a few states, PBMs have attempted to sue states because of the legislation, and they have not prevailed. It is very critical to support this legislation, Senate Bill 38, in Alaska, because of the critical service that independent pharmacies provide to rural clientele. And with that, I have a list here of the folks who are available. Rich Holt, Barry Christensen, Emily Ricci, and Lori Wing-Heyer are all here to answer questions and give testimony if needed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Going back to slide number 20, you have the third bullet point, prohibits extrapolation in assessing fees and penalties. When I looked into this bill, one particular person said that the extrapolation is a federal issue, it's Medicaid, and that defines the extrapolation. It's not necessarily the PBM's, directing that. It's in Medicaid. Can you comment on that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the Medicaid plans and audits are do not apply under this bill because they are federal. DHSS hires private contractors to do those audits, so the Medicaid plans are not subject to this legislation.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So then there could technically be two different audits for a pharmacy, one for self-insurers, private insurers that would not use extrapolating techniques, and then another audit maybe done by a different organization or at a different time under Medicaid received sold drugs than would use extrapolation. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is my understanding, and we could verify that with one of our experts that are online, but that is my understanding.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So following along with that, then I assume that the Native Health Corporations are also exempt from this.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. That is, I believe, correct. We are reaching out currently to the Native Health organizations about their pharmacies, but I believe those are more internal with the clinics and hospitals out there, and I believe those would all be federally regulated.
Thank you.
Senator Giesel, Ms. Conway, thank you for presenting SB 38. I did have two individuals, I believe, I don't know if they're in the room or online, in the room. If I could ask Emily Ritchie as well as Lori Heyer to join us at the microphone. If you could identify yourself for the record and then please provide the committee opening comments on Senate Bill 38, Labor and Commerce version.
I'm Lori Wing Heyer, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. This bill has been under discussion in many states. When I was recently at NEIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, we were advised that NCOIL, insurance legislators, would be picking up a PBM bill, and they hope to have it out to the states in December this year. We look at this as we do all aspects of health care. There is nothing that we want to do to raise the cost of health care, but there is no doubt that these are huge organizations to which we have little insight into. There are concerns from the pharmacist on the cost of what they are reimbursed, the extrapolation, the cost of the audits or the contracts to them, as they appear to be one-sided. So there is some legitimate concerns on the part of the pharmacist. When PBMs were started, they most definitely did save money. But in reality, we didn't like them, because when they started, they were administrators and they were mail-order pharmacies. And none of us liked mail-order pharmacies. We liked going to the local pharmacist to pick up our drugs. So they changed from mail order to regulating the community pharmacist and pushing down the prices. And now it appears we have a gorilla in the room. I can't tell you what all has happened to the pharmacists. I'm hearing the same stories you are. We have not had insights into the PBMs, but there is no doubt that this is a hot topic amongst most states right now as to the regulation of PBM and how does a state control them without the inadvertent cost or inadvertently raising the cost of health care.
Thank you, Ms. Winkheimer. Ms. Ritchie, could you provide us your name for the record and then any comments on Senate Bill 38, Labor and Commerce?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Emily Ritchie. I'm the Chief Health Policy Administrator in the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And we have also been aware of this bill for a significant number of years. And in reviewing the bill, we have worked closely both with the independent pharmacists who have come to us with our concerns regarding the Alaska Care, both the employee and the retiree plan, as well as our contractor, Aetna, and their subcontractor, CVS Caremark. And I will echo, I think, the remarks of Director Wingheyer. This is a highly, highly complex arrangement where the division has a relationship directly with the pharmacy benefit manager. The pharmacy benefit manager, in turn, has contractual relationships with different pharmacies. The pharmacies, in turn, have additional contractual relationships with wholesale distributors and purchasing services administrative organizations. The PBMs, in turn, have additional contractual relationships with the drug manufacturers. And none of these entities are privy to the relationships that the other entities have. So we see kind of a very narrow perspective as far as drug claims that are paid out on our end. And our first priority is always, we have a fiduciary responsibility to the plan. So our first priority is to ensure that If there is, if we anticipate a fiscal impact to the plan, that of course we communicate that so that this body can consider that. We have worked with the bill sponsors to address the areas of fiscal impact that we saw in the latest bill version. Our department is neutral on this bill. We do not have a position, but it is, quite frankly, a very, very complex topic where multiple entities have relationships with limited visibility.
Thank you for those comments. Any questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So my understanding is that there has been some, you said this bill's been around for a while, and that, can you confirm that there's been efforts in 2012-14, somewhere around that time, where PBMs and pharmacists kind of came together to try to negotiate kind of on their own or kind of come to an agreement outside of the necessity of this bill? Has that, to your knowledge, has that occurred and has that been successful?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, for the record, Emily Ricci, Division of Retirement and Benefits. I do believe that there was an effort. I was not part of it, but I believe it happened maybe 2 or 3 years ago with certain representatives from the Pharmacy Benefit Managers and the local Independent Pharmacists Association. I don't know the content of those discussions or those efforts, but I imagine that they were not successful because the bill is here again.
With that, I'd ask members to set this bill aside. Thank you for joining us at the microphone today.
I just got to write the spot down, okay?
I'd like to direct committee members' attention to Senate Bill 185, Education, an Act Relating to Reemployment of Persons Who Retired Under the Teachers Retirement System. I'd like to invite Rachel Hanke, staff to Senator Machicki, to the table. Senator Machicki, you're fine where you're at. If you'd like to give us some opening comments on this bill, brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Machicki, could you give us an overview on what is before us, what issue we're trying to solve, and how this bill solves it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the committee hearing Senate Bill 185 today. This is about the Alaska School District's significant staffing challenges today. As you'll see a letter from NEA in this packet that from Mr. Parker, the president of NEA, that says at least 250 unfilled positions across Alaska this school year. And at the superintendent, as the superintendents have said, that at the Alaska Teacher Placement Job Fair, there were hardly any applicants. This bill is not about getting in the way of hiring permanent qualified teachers. This is about temporarily filling positions as they come available. It requires that they advertise, the districts advertise and try to fill those positions with new instructors, as the vast majority of instructors are in our school districts around the state. But what it does allow them to do is to temporarily fill the position with a qualified retired employee. It requires that they're retired for 6 months if the educator is younger than the age of 62, or 60 days if the educator is age 62 or older, and then allow them to temporarily fill those vacancies with qualified retired teachers until a permanent teacher can be rehired. It's interesting, Madam Chair, because this bill just allows educators to do what all they can today hire retired teachers from all other states to come to Alaska and take these positions, but they can't hire our own retired educators to temporarily fill these positions. So what it does is allows them to continue to be paid their normal retirement. They don't incur additional retirement benefits on the system. The district still has to pay their 12.56% of base salary for the teacher, so there's no difference in cost for the districts. And as you can see by the fiscal note, it's indeterminate because it depends on the length of time that folks have been retired. And the last thing I'd like to say, Madam Chair, is that in the entire 10 years that this occurred from 2001 to 2010, there was an average of 32 retirees that were rehired per year. That was the total utilization of the program. It's hard to say how many will be used in the current atmosphere with educators, but we believe that it's an important tool to make sure that we have qualified teachers taking the place in our classrooms until those positions can be filled permanently. With that, Madam Chair, those are my opening statements.
Thank you. Are there questions to the sponsor on what the problem is and what we're trying to accomplish? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think this is a very good bill in many ways, but I wonder if you could help me understand why the difference whether a teacher is 62 years or aged older or younger, what's the point of that clause?
It has to do with the IRS ruling.
Senator Michiki.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Stevens, it has to do with the IRS ruling, and I will leave that, Madam Chair, when we have our witnesses up here to discuss the specifics of that issue, if I can.
Senator Stevens, could we hold on that answer?
Absolutely.
Or a more in-depth answer? Other questions? Ms. Hanke, could you provide us your name for the record, any opening comments, and then please proceed with the sectional analysis so that we understand the mechanics of the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rachel Hanke, staff to Senator Michiki. Section 1 adds new section to AS 1420, which does a number of things. A, allows school districts to rehire educators that have retired under the defined benefit plan or the defined contribution plan when, B, one, the retired member certifies that there was no prearrangement of reemployment made prior to retirement, B, two, the member has been retired for at least 60 days if they're 62 years of age or older, 6 months if the member is younger than 62 years of age. C, the school district has adopted a rehire policy by resolution that is publicly, they have publicly advertised a position for 10 business days and is actively recruiting to fill the position with a person other than a retired member. D, reemployment contracts may not exceed 12 consecutive months. E, the school district that hires a retiree must provide the administrator with a copy of the resolution and policy required by E, as well as a report stating the retiree's name, description of the circumstances, and actions taken to comply with the policy. The school district is also required to make contributions to AS 1425070. F, certain requirements of the section don't apply to a rehire member that's eligible for restoration of tenure rights. Section 2 allows retirees who are rehired as permitted by Section 1 to continue to receive retirement benefits during the period of reemployment unless they become an active member. Section 3 makes retirees who are reemployed as permitted by Section 1 ineligible to receive additional retirement benefits based on their service and salary during the period of reemployment. Section 4 clarifies that a member who is reemployed does not become an active member. The member will continue to receive retirement benefits, deductions under TERS will not be made to their salary, and reemployed educators will not receive credited time for service during that reemployment. The section also ensures that a retired and rehired teacher will be eligible to receive the group health plan coverage that's provided to active members employed by the school district if they so choose. Section 5 inserts reference to Section 1, which will require the employer to make TERS contributions for reemployed retirees at a rate of 12.56%, and Section 6 applies the bill's provisions to contracts made on or after the effective date.
Are there questions from committee members on the structure of the bill? I'd like to welcome Senator Olson. Welcome, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, we've all been thinking about you and your family.
Thank you.
Right now we have SB 185 in front of us, and we just completed a sectional analysis. Again, questions from committee members on the structure? I have one on page 2, line 12 and 13. A contract for reemployment under A of this section may not exceed 12 consecutive months. So either to Ms. Hanke or to the sponsor, the intent is 12 months and gone, is my guess. And I'm wondering if a retired teacher then can move from district to district and start a new contract and then continue to receive benefits. So the contract can't be written for more than 12 months, but can they be then consecutively, can they just re-up new contracts?
Madam Chair, all teachers' contracts are for 12 months or less. They would be available to have other contracts if they so chose, but the districts would have to go through the same process. This is not to replace existing teachers. The districts save no money. It is about filling a position that can't be filled through the normal channels for whatever reason. And it's also not the purpose of replacing collective bargaining. Madam Chair, each district has its own individual collective bargaining units. It depends on their definition of a teacher and whether or not they end up being in a represented class.
Senator Michicki, if a retired teacher exited at $50,000 a year and a new teacher is hired at $35,000 a year, does the new teacher that's being rehired and receiving the retirement benefits get $35,000 or $50,000?
Madam Chair, each instructor is hired on an individual basis. That is a negotiation that would occur with the districts, but just being someone who's managed large organizations, as you've been involved, when you can fill a position with a new $35,000 a year instructor, that's going to be your first choice. That would be up to the needs of the individual district or the individual school. They would have to determine what works best for them financially. But to answer it more simply, you don't carry your final year's salary with you. This is on a case-by-case, individual-by-individual basis.
Senator Michicki, some time ago, as far as the state goes, and I wasn't here during that, there were specific provisions placed in Alaska state statute, as I recall, that would not allow you to retire and take your retirement wage and come back, because it was a past practice that the state had used, and they found it, again, as I recall, not cost-effective because people were coming back at their ending salaries, drawing their retirement benefits from one system and then receiving additional benefits as they came into the system. So we have been down this road before, at least at a state level, and chose to not go back and do that again. So just put that out there. We'll have to do more research to see why those provisions were put in place, but they were a different set of circumstances for sure than education. Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I believe I understand Senator Michigi's response, and it seems to me that this negotiation is between the district and that individual teacher. So it could be at the higher salary they received, or it could be at the beginning teacher salary. So it's entirely up to the district to negotiate that the salary. There's no commitment here that a person who has retired at $50,000 come back at that level. I believe that's correct, isn't it, Senator?
Senator Michicki.
That is absolutely correct. And they also have no additional benefits other than what they're receiving, so all they would have is the actual pay of the position. And again, we hope that all teaching positions can be filled with new, excited young teachers that are appropriately qualified for those positions, but the reality of it is we're struggling, and districts are struggling. And when we hear from Ms. Parody, she'll discuss in more detail the challenges they're having today.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Certainly a worthy conversation that we are about to begin. I would just say in response, Senator Stevens, that the state of Alaska pays for what the districts negotiate. And so it is, if there's a fiscal impact, which I believe we have an updated fiscal note on, that's our job, to appropriately understand that impact, and understanding that not too long ago, I think it was last week, we had multiple education professionals at our table saying that flat funding was not helping them, and this particular tool will increase the stress, or could increase the stress on the existing system. But not having teachers in the classroom certainly is an issue that we need to discuss. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and you're absolutely right. We do pay that bill eventually, and it's on us. Another question I'd have, though, and just crossed my mind is, is the University of Alaska, why are they not included in this? I'd like to know from the university if this would be an advantage for them or not. Rather than just school districts, maybe it should be all TERS employees. And I think it's important to hear from the university about their position on that.
Senator Stevens, if you could work with the sponsor on that. At this point, I don't plan on bringing the university to the table, but they're certainly welcome to contact Senator Machicki's office. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Ms. Hanke, thank you for bringing this bill before us. Thank you, Senator Machicki. I'd like to invite Lisa Parody, Executive Director of ACSA, under invited testimony to the microphone. Dr. Karen Gebrick. Parody, if you could introduce yourself for the record, and please provide opening comments on Senate Bill 185 from Education.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 185. For the record, my name is Lisa Skiles Parody, the Executive Director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. We represent superintendents, elementary and secondary principals, school business officials, and other school administrators. I want to briefly thank Senator Machicki and his staff for working with us to bring this bill forward today to help education. My testimony, I'll note, is also being given in full support of Norm Wooten, who's the Executive Director of the Alaska Association of School Boards. We are in strong support of SB 185 as a tool that will help school districts in a time where they need immediate help to fill vacancies with high-quality staff for our students. It is not a silver bullet, but it can provide some relief. It is a tool, a stopgap. SB 185, Retire, Rehire, would allow for the re-employment of retired educators to help districts fill vacancies, and is a necessary tool to help meet school district personnel needs in both urban and rural districts. I briefly want to thank Kathy Lee, who's the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits with the Department of Administration. We've been working with her for over the last year and a half to make sure that the bill before you envelops the necessary IRS Treasury regulations and other important pieces that they feel had to be in the bill. So I think we've reached that balance. At the end of the day, this is a basic education supply and demand issue. This legislation is vital because, as you are aware, we have a critical shortage of supply in Alaska. Our members are making the hiring decision in each district, and they deal directly with the increasing difficulty of doing so today. We were in Senate Education, a joint education meeting this morning. It was every seat filled with members talking about this critical shortage of educators, and Our membership, each of you have received this before when I've testified, so I won't give it to you again, but you will remember that preparing, attracting, and retaining qualified educators is one of our very highest priorities. Alaska is experiencing a shortage that we've never seen before. And so in response, our members strongly encourage the development of comprehensive statewide programs to prepare, attract, and retain high-quality educators and professionals. This legislation is a piece of that equation. The Alaska reflects a national shortage of teachers and educators, but has even greater struggles because of our remoteness coupled with our loss of competitiveness. Against the backdrop of our national educator shortage, our retirement system and wages for the cost of living here do not draw from the lower 48 as it once did. Just a snapshot of that shortage, in 2015, there's some research out of Penn that said there are, at that point, by way of example, 3.3 million teachers. The same year, we had over 500,000 teachers leave the profession, but we only replenished in the United States with just over 300,000. So we have this ongoing deficit at the national level, and we're feeling that exasperated here in Alaska. It used to be, and you heard this from Senator Michiki, that teachers and educators would come from all over to attend the Alaska Teacher Job Fair. There'd be lines out the door. I know Senator McKinnon, Chairman McKinnon, remembers that. Last year at the ATP Job Fair, there were more hiring personnel than applicants. There were 211 registrants with 39 from out of state. This year, a month ago, we had 165 applicants. The majority of school districts trying to hire them, and 25 were from out of Alaska. Just to give you some context of how hard we're struggling and why we have vacancies. And just to put some specifics on the shortage and look closer at our Alaska numbers, with superintendents, 24% of the districts have had a new superintendent in 2016-2017, 24%. Looking at the years from 2013 to 2017, 72% of districts experienced at least one change of superintendents in that five-year period. Principals, we have approximately 400 principals in the state. In 2016 and 17, 26% of the principals were new to their building. And with teachers, which has been an ongoing concern in Alaska, and it's gotten worse, we have approximately 8,000 teachers in 2016-2017. And the definition that I'm working with is retention, the percent of teachers who came back. Our average percent of teachers retained in Alaska was 72%. But when you break that down by locale, our rural areas are really struggling, and I'd like to share those numbers with you. Urban, which would be Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, retention numbers are about 83%. You go to urban fringe, which would be off the road, maybe a Palmer, or on the road, but a fringe would be a Palmer or a Sitka at 76%. Rural fringe would be 71%, and rural remote is 57%. So if you think about the further we go out, the worse this problem is. This bill, and I think I need to wrap, but I'd like to say that the last time we had this in place, we had a total of 325 retired individuals take advantage of it. So it's not opening the floodgates. The average time of reemployment was 18.7 months. The shortest was 3 months. The employer using the highest number was Lower Kuskokwim School District, our largest rural district. And teachers, we had 149 teachers use it. A lot of special education teachers, 45. So I wanted to share that perspective with you. We appreciate your consideration of this bill. Our students will benefit by having an experienced leadership, experienced teachers, experienced educators in these classrooms when we are not able to fill these vacancies. Thank you.
Questions from committee members? Ms. Parody, when was the last time that something like this was tried, if we have experience with it?
Madam Chairman, the The bill sunset was in 2009, and I believe it ran from 2001 through 2010, sunset in 2009, and the Department of Administration has very, very specific records of the usage during that time.
Thank you for those comments. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have an idea of what the provisions of hiring were during the 2001 through 2010, and how does that differ, if in any way, if at all, from the proposed legislation we have before us?
Madam Chairman, Senator Hoffman, it's an excellent question. The bill was structured based on the legislation from last time, and then we included current regulations that were required by the IRS letter ruling that I believe just went into play this year. So that's where the waiting periods that Senator Michicki referred to came from. So those are new to what's been added, making it more difficult to do this. And also, it has sufficient requirements to greatly reduce the likelihood that the bill will impact a current TRS member's decision to retire, because of that bona fide separation of employment, the 60 days, the 6 months, as well as now, you can't do prearrangements. I mean, there's risk to the individual if they don't follow the law. So those are new to this legislation. There's been more safeguards built into it since then, but essentially the same with additional safeguards, if you will.
Thank you for those comments. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Perry. If I could ask Dr. Karen Gaborik?
Gaborik,
thank you. Welcome to Senate Finance. If you please try to limit your testimony, we do have multiple people in the audience wishing to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify on SB 185. For the record, my name is Dr. Karen Gaborik. I'm superintendent in Fairbanks. And I'm also president of the Alaska Superintendents Association. As representative for the Alaska Superintendents, I'd like to express our collective support of SB 185. It's a bill that will positively impact every single public school student in Alaska. And I appreciate the efforts of Dr. Parity to help build or move this bill forward. While Fairbanks is on the road system, and that comes with some benefits in terms of recruiting and retention, in recent years, Fairbanks has experienced teacher shortages in positions that we have not had to worry about in the past. We frequently have unfilled vacancies in special education positions, such as occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, school psychologists. We're constantly recruiting and traveling to recruit for those. However, recently we've had regular education teacher vacancies in areas such as high school math, high school science, physics, chemistry, calculus, those sorts of things, and also music. It is not a good situation for kids when in an urban setting you have the revolving door of substitute teachers attempting to fill that gap. Many subs are not certified teachers, let alone content area experts. So then you have other teachers trying to fill in the gaps by writing lesson plans, prepping for an extra set of classes that they don't have, basically so that kids don't fall behind. So at that point, then teachers are doing two jobs to try to support kids. You also have school and district administrators filling in for teacher vacancies in some cases. And then as you heard, the issues in Fairbanks are minimal compared to the challenges of vacancies in rural Alaska. Just this weekend, I heard a rural superintendent describing his school year, and this included him attempting to not only be superintendent and school principal, but also a middle school teacher due to a vacancy in his district. So in spite of his great commitment and effort, that is not a formula of success for anybody. I have outstanding retired teachers in Fairbanks who would be willing to fill a teaching position on a short-term basis. They would probably be the first to tell you that a short-term basis would be key to that decision. It could be a month, a semester, or a year, with the understanding that we would continue to attempt to fill the position permanently. And I believe across the state there are teachers, retired teachers, who would help and be willing to help with this issue. And this relates directly to another concern at our Superintendents Association, and that's the turnover rate in the principal and superintendent ranks. You heard about the 25% change that we're in superintendents that we're already looking at next year. Over the last 4 years, a 75% turnover in superintendents. And so, again, it's looking for the ability for both school districts and school boards to hire retired educators, teachers, building administrators, in some cases superintendents, while Alaska navigates the current current state and national educator shortage. And it's critical, and I appreciate the efforts to give us another tool to address that issue. So thank you for consideration of this bill.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Yaborik, as I understand it, you are precluded from hiring a retired Alaska teacher, as the rules now are, but you can hire a retired teacher from Oregon, Washington, or California.
Correct.
And that seems to just be innately unfair to me.
Well, again, when you have people in your own community who could fill these positions, who may have actually taught in a particular school in a particular content area, and in our case, so the most that we can hire them, greatest level we can hire them at is just under a 0.5, so they can help a little bit. You know, they can fill a 0.49 position and not negatively impact their retirement, but they can't fill a. So then you start piecing things together if you can, and that's not good for kids either.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair. The point I'm trying to make is that we currently can hire out-of-state teachers who have retired in other states, but we cannot hire Alaskan teachers.
We can, through the chair. Yes, we can, and we do hire retired teachers from other states. And
thank you for that question and those comments. Thank you. I'd like to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 185, an act relating to reemployment of persons who retired under the teachers' retirement system. We do timestamps. Superintendent Bishop, I see that you're online for questions. Do you have comments for the committee's consideration?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dina Bishop. I'm the superintendent of the Anchor School District, testifying in support of Senate Bill 185. And I just want to touch base that and make it clear that we actually do, ASD has accessed the extensive experience of expertise of retired employees and educators by allowing for temporary and part-time employment. Right now in state statute, we can hire as a 0.49 or less. Nevertheless, our efforts to capitalize on such talented and veteran workforce has been limited without a full-time provision of reemployment of retirees that this bill would allow. And I know you have quite a few people testifying in support, so I'm just going to keep it simple. I just want to assure you that the reemployment of retired teachers is not pursued in ASD to avoid the hire of new teachers. Retirees fill gaps when properly certified staff can't be hired in those hard-to-fill areas. They provide temporary or short-term expertise for special projects or initiatives, and they give needed support during high-demand times of the year, such as during summer months, the start of the school year, during assessments. Just on behalf of ASD, we recognize the fiscal realities which you're facing and appreciate your willingness to provide school district with increased flexibility and discretion in a time of constricting resources. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support for your work. And again, this isn't an answer to everything, but it just allows us one more tool in our toolbox to be able to hire the best for Alaska's kids. We need good teachers. Just as an educational environment, we're falling behind. I want to be able to access the very best, and many of our retired teachers are the best. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Ms. Bishop. If you could call my office to coordinate a telephone conversation, that would be helpful.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you. The next person waiting to testify in the room, Norm Wooten. And I'd also like to invite Mark Miller to the microphone. Welcome to Senate Finance. Your name for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Norm Wooten. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. I speak to you this morning in support of SB 185. The ASB Delegate Assembly has had a resolution in place to support retire rehire of teachers and administrators since 2008 when the previous bill, the previous provision was due to sunset. I previously testified in support of this before Senate Education and the companion bill before House Education. There's a shortage of teachers and administrators nationwide, and Alaska is no different in that respect. This is especially true for hard-to-fill positions such as special education, high school math and science, principals. Districts are traveling to outside job fairs all over the United States to job fairs to recruit, and as well as utilizing creative tactics that they've never had to before to recruit teachers. Last week, as I was waiting in the Anchorage airport for a flight back to Juneau, I was just past the time, I was watching the airport channel there in front of me, and there was an advertisement with a video from the Northwest Arctic Borough School District advertising on that venue for teachers and administrators to apply in that district. AASB, along with the Alaska Superintendents Association, has had to appeal on numerous occasions to the retirement division for a waiver to permit retired superintendents to fill interim positions for late in the season positions when the candidate pool was too narrow for a good selection. The retire-rehire is not a permanent solution. AASB, along with our educational colleagues in the education community, are working with the UA system to attract and to retain teachers and administrators in our system. However, this bill would alleviate the shortage in the near term. We thank the sponsor, Senator McKitchie, for sponsoring this bill, and we thank the Senate Finance Committee for hearing this bill. And that concludes my testimony, Madam Chair.
Norm, thank you for joining Senate Finance today. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I know you're trying to get through a lot of material here, but I think we need to have it clarified with Mr. Wooten that we are not talking about – this is the teacher's retirement system. We're not talking just about teachers. We're also including in that administrators, and we need to hire principals or even superintendents.
Yes. Through the chair. Yes, sir, Senator Stevens. That's true.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Thank you, Mr. Wooten.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask Mary Wagner to join us at the microphone. Mr. Miller, welcome to Senate Finance.
Hi, Dr. Mark Miller, Superintendent, Juneau School District. I also speak in support of this bill. If I have an open position, I have really two options. I can try to fill it with a sub who often only have a high school degree. It's interesting to have a 23-year-old teaching 18-year-olds subbing. It makes for an interesting dynamic. The problem with doing that, though, quite honestly, is many days in my district, our sub-fill rate is 50% or less. That means on any given day in either of my high schools, you will go in and you will see students supervised by somebody sitting around in the cafeteria or foyer because there is no teacher to sub for them in that class during that period. The other option that I have is to contact a company down in the lower 48 and contract with them to send somebody from Oregon or Washington up to fill services that we can't fill internally, which means our tax dollars, Alaskan tax dollars, get fed back to the lower 48 to feed their economy. I really don't see this as much as a finance issue as I do a resource issue. And the resource that I'm talking about, I hope I don't offend anybody at the table, but with possibly one exception, are the people sitting at this table, which are the kind of aging baby boomers, I hope nobody takes offense to that, who have retired or are looking at retiring soon, but still have a lot to contribute to our society, as I believe everybody sitting at this table does. Allowing our aging boomers who want to come back on a part-time basis to contribute to our education system by doing what they do best and have done best their whole life makes a whole bunch of sense in a number of different ways. And so I again, encourage you to support the bill. Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Just a quick comment. You didn't offend me. 70 is the new 50.
All right. Senator McChicken.
And actually, I just wanted to thank you for pointing me out as the younger member. That's very nice.
Senator McChicken, I think that was a reference to Senator Von Imhoff, but I didn't want to burst your bubble.
Yeah, I am Generation X.
Through the chair, I abstain and take the fifth on any more comment today.
Thank you. Thank you for all that all of you do for our students. It is appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance. I'd like to invite Sean Dusick, the Kenai Peninsula Borough, to the microphone. Mary Wagner, welcome to Senate Finance. Your comments for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee, hello. My name is Dr. Mary Wagner, and I am the superintendent in the Sitka School District. And I'm here today to testify in support of SB 185, the reemployment and rehire of retired teachers. First of all, I want to thank you for your support of public education in Alaska, and thank you for putting forward this bill. At the middle of the year, about December, January, I checked to see how many teacher vacancies were posted on Alaska Teacher Placement. There were 153 teachers. In Sitka, we have just under 120 teachers. That means that an entire school district, plus more, had no teachers or administrators, the equivalent of that. And that really struck me, because that is unacceptable. Our students need to have quality educators and quality administrators in the classroom. And the thought that the schools would be teacherless was shocking to me. And it got me motivated to be involved with this. As Senator Stevens mentioned, we can hire teachers from other states. We would like to be able to hire the most qualified people we can on a long-term basis. This is not a benefit to the district other than we can have qualified teachers for our students. Providing an excellent education every day to every student requires experienced teachers, a culturally responsive learning environment, and targeted instruction to meet the student's individual learning needs, all of which can help us strive to achieve the three commitments of Alaska's Education Challenge, which are increasing student success, cultivating safety and well-being, and supporting responsible and reflective learners. By shutting out Alaska retired teachers, we are wasting a valuable resource. SB 185 simply provides a tool, as others have mentioned, for districts to use and does not require any district to employ retired or teachers or administrators. And when I testified previously to the Senate Education Committee, Senator Stevens asked me a question. And I think it's an important question. And we do not have a problem right now in Sitka of attracting teachers. However, as you have heard, this is very short-lived. We will have a problem attracting teachers. This is for everybody that needs this, whether it's been an ongoing issue or whether it will be a future issue. There is a teacher and administrator shortage in Alaska, and our students deserve to have classrooms with teachers and schools with administrators in them. So thank you for taking my testimony, and thank you again for all that you do for public education in Alaska.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Wagner. I'd like to invite Kathy Lee. Kathy, if you're in the room, if you could join us at the microphone. Mr. Dussek, your name for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sean Dussek. I'm the Superintendent of Schools for the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District. I speak in support of this bill, and I wanted to thank Senator Marchicki for looking beyond his district. This is a statewide issue, and I appreciate his support beyond the Kenai, because, quite frankly, this is not a serious issue in the Kenai at this time, and I want to make sure that's fully recognized, because over 30% of our teaching staff can retire now, today, if they so choose. And also, for the record, I am a part of Generation X, even though I may not look like it. But I can retire as well. So we are on the cusp of a potential shortage on the Kenai. A couple of things to note in this bill. A lot of things have been discussed that I was going to touch on, but they took my thunder. But this really is a bridge in my mind between the goals for the UA system of supplying the vast majority of our teaching staff in the future. We have a lot of great retired teachers, particularly on the Kenai, that are there and available. And Senator McKinnon, I wanted to thank you for your efforts in innovating in public education. I think that this is also a bridge, a tool for that bridge. As we have on the Kenai, we're doing a lot of work innovating, and we're training our teachers, putting a lot of resources into that, even though they can retire right now. If they are available and they have high-quality training, they can spread out across the state over the next few years as that bridge to meet the needs of our kids individually. So I think that's an exciting opportunity. Again, this is just one tool in the toolbox, and I appreciate all of your support, and thank you for all the effort you put in and all the hard decisions that are facing you. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for joining us in Senate Finance today. Is there anyone else online or in the room wishing to testify on Senate Bill 185? We have someone coming up from the back, and then I'll catch the front row. Sorry, Ms. Lee, I thought we were done.
Uh,
Welcome. Your name for the record.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Bobby Boland, superintendent with the Bering Strait School District, and just wanted to speak in support of Senate Bill 185 to you and the committee today. The Bering Strait School District last year had 6 certified teaching positions that were never filled. That means students in multiple sites across 15 schools were left without qualified instructors and overworked teachers that remain at the school. This year, BSSD has 56 openings for next year already. The district has been actively recruiting across the country for new certified teachers and administrators to fill these openings. We still have currently 36 openings for next year. Not only is attending recruitment fairs expensive, comparable to the return of actually filling a teacher, but takes staff away from our jobs, and that being the most important thing, educating our children. In addition, as of all the districts recruiting in the same places, for every one good candidate, that we have at least 4 options, and we're competing against each other for these positions, leaving the rest waiting for the next great candidate. As superintendent in a large rural district, the need to fill positions is critical and an ever-increasing problem. I've been in the region for 10 years, and we are in the worst situation that I've seen since then. So I just want to thank the committee for taking time to consider our needs for filling these positions. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Boland, can you just kind of describe, since you're right in the middle of my district, describe what happens when you lose these certified teachers? Because in Golovin, we lost almost half this teacher population, and what resources you had to go to try and fill those positions.
Right. Through the chair, Senator Olson. We have, obviously we spend most of our time going out into the lower 48 looking for teachers. My board will come back to me asking why I'm gone from my job so much. It's because I'm trying to find people to work, for us. The reality is we have teachers that have to fill in for those empty spaces, and whether it's writing lesson plans or whether it's covering classes, we're already have multiple grade levels in rural Alaska. So, one teacher may be teaching third, fourth, fifth grade, 15 kids, and it's very difficult to teach a curriculum to multiple grade levels at the same time when you're the only teacher in that area. So, putting that additional burden because there is no fourth grade teacher or fifth grade teacher just creates a compounding problem as we move forward, and it gets tougher throughout the school year, and then we start over again, and we never get to a place where we feel like we're ahead of the game.
Madam Chair, just want to comment, if you would. Superintendent Miller from Juneau here talked about the substitution fill rate that he had. And in Golovin, they were filling those substitute teachers with high school students that had just graduated the year before because of the extreme shortage that was out there. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Boland.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So in some rural communities, how much do you think teacher housing, available for housing, is a contributing factor to hiring and maintaining a workforce?
Through the chair, we have we are our own landlords in rural Alaska, and we're always battling the conditions of keeping upkeep for housing. But right now the problem is not housing, because we don't have teachers to put in that housing. So it'd be great to have a bigger housing problem by not having enough bedrooms, because I have enough teachers to fill every position.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance.
Thank you.
I believe I saw another hand go up. If you could join us at the microphone, your name for the record.
Good morning. My name's Monica Goyette. I'm the superintendent in Mat-Su, and I want to thank you for hearing our support for this bill. Anytime we can have flexibility in hiring it increases the chances that we're going to get higher quality individuals. And I just want to speak to a question that was asked earlier on about pay with teachers. We treat retired teachers as new hires. So they are allowed to bring in a maximum of 3 years of experience, and they do receive the education credit. So they usually, when you're retired, you're at the end of our salary schedule, and if you come back as a rehire, then you go back to the beginning of that pay scale. Thank you, and we really appreciate your time and effort on this.
Monica, I do have a question.
Yes.
That would be your statement on the 3 years in educational certification. That is an individual district policy versus a broad policy that's addressed in this bill.
That's
right?
Correct. I just wanted you to know, we're the second largest district, and really that I believe this is an opportunity to give individuals more money. This really, we're still very prudent with the dollars that we're given.
Thank you for all you do for our students. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 185? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Ms. Lee, if you could provide the committee comments from the administration on the bill before us.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Lee. I'm the Chief Pension Officer and Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The administration's position on this bill is neutral. I am also available to answer any questions you may have on the fiscal note or on the requirement for a bona fide termination of employment.
If you could proceed, I'm sorry, what was the last comment that you made?
The provisions of a bona fide termination of employment.
If you could put that on the record, a provision for bona fide termination, and then cover the fiscal note for us.
Thank you. In January of 2018, the Division of Retirement and Benefits implemented an IRS requirement for a bona fide termination of employment. This is in order to prevent what's termed a sham retirement, where someone is of retirement age, retires, but never leaves their position. They continue working for the same employer. The IRS views this as an in-service distribution, and since our plans do not allow for in-service distribution, we had to promulgate regulations to identify and clarify what is a bona fide termination of employment using the IRS rules surrounding that. So the IRS requires that a person who is of normal retirement age, and they define that as age 62, regardless of what the plan's normal retirement age is to receive benefits. So if a person is under age 62 and terminates employment but wants to come back to work for the same employer, there can be no prearrangement for any work after that person has retired or it is considered a sham termination. If they're under age 62, they must wait 6 months before they can reemploy. If they're age 62 or older, they must wait at least 60 days. So we requested that these provisions be placed into this bill so that it is clear what the rehire provisions are.
Ms. Lee, if you could pause there for a moment. Senator Stevens, you had that question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you are responsible for explaining the IRS to us, so maybe you can tell us what's the sense of that? What's the point of that? I mean, if it is a rule, we have to follow it, but it doesn't seem to make much sense to me that you have a difference between 6 months and 60 days. Is there something rational that we can grab onto there and understand?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think this is the second time you've asked me to explain the
IRS. And I still didn't understand it the first time, huh?
In any plan, because we are a tax-qualified plan, there has to be a mark at which it's considered a normal retirement for any type of government plan or private sector plan. This is because the contributions that are made to the plan are made on a pre-tax basis. So the IRS is looking at when it can receive the tax for the pre-tax contributions that have been made, and to make sure that that is being received at the appropriate time. So the concept revolves around what's called an in-service distribution. Some private sector plans have a provision that you can continue working and receive your retirement benefit at a particular point in time when you reach normal retirement age. Our plans do not contain that type of a provision. In our plan, when you retire, under the standard statutes, you are prohibited from coming back into work if you're in a position of, for the teachers, of 50% or more of a standard contract. Under the standard provisions, then your retirement benefit is stopped. While you are working, you earn a second retirement benefit based on the service and salaries for that second period of employment. So we have no in-service distribution provision. If we were to allow retirees to retire and then immediately come back to work, we would be in violation of the IRS rules, and that would affect our tax qualification. So we're required to put these bona fide termination rules into effect for the plans in order to protect it. So the bona fide termination includes no prearrangement for reemployment, as well as the waiting periods.
Thank you for that clarity. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you get with my office? I'd like to talk to you about that point. Not right now, though.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. If I could direct your attention, committee members, to the fiscal note. Ms. Lee, could you cover the indeterminate fiscal note?
The fiscal note is indeterminate because we don't know how many people will participate in this program, nor do we know from which group they will participate from. So there are two groups of concern here, and depending on how many people from each group participate, that determines the cost or potential savings to the plan. So the two groups are those that are already retired before the effective date of this bill. The second group is those who will retire after the effective date of this bill. So from the existing retiree population, if any of them return to employment, there will actually be a savings to the plan because they will come under their active employment insurance, and that will relieve some of the costs to the retiree health plan. However, if a person is not retired until after the effective date of this bill, that can create a cost because of the way the systems are valued. When a system is closed, as the TERS DB plan is, actuaries try to get an accurate evaluation of the cost and impacts of any changes to the plan in order not to overstate or understate what the liability is. So the assumptions on plan value change from an assumption that we have people coming in, people going out, and we can assume that we can value the retirement liability based on a normal retirement date, to what is the plan's actual experience. If our plan's actual experience was that everyone retired exactly on their normal retirement date, that would drive costs up. However, our plan experience is that members will retire after their normal retirement date up to 4 years and possibly longer. So the fund is not made whole for the cost of that benefit right at 4 years. That's kind of more of a simple explanation. They do have a table that they use, a table of probability. So if you work a year, there's a percent probability you'll retire the next year and the next year and the next year, and it keeps on going until you actually retire. So at this point, the benefits for those who are ready to retire or coming up onto retirement are not fully funded at their normal retirement age. We're assuming that they'll work at least 4 years longer and that we have 4 additional years to fund that benefit. This bill could incentivize those people to retire now instead of 4 years from now, and that could create a cost. So the fiscal note, what the fiscal note is showing you is a band of results that might occur. We asked the actuary to use all of the information that we had gathered from the prior programs. We had 325 distinct individuals participate in the retiree rehire from 2001 to 2010. So they are showing a band of 200 rehired retirees and another at 400. So if 100% of those come from the current retiree population, there actually would be a savings to the plan. So for 200 retirees, it would be $2.2 million in savings. For 400 retirees, it would be $4.3 million in savings. But as more retirees come from the currently active population, there starts to create a cost. The break-even point is at 93%. So up to 93% utilization by retirees, there is either a savings or no cost. After that, there is a cost. So for the 200 retirees, 186 of them would have to come from the current retiree population for there to be no cost. So we're providing you this band because there is no way to tell who's going to participate from which group. And so we're providing the band so that you can make your own assessment as to whether or not teachers who are currently active would be incentivized to retire with the bona fide separation provisions that are also in this bill.
Thank you for that coverage. With that, we need to set this bill aside. Senator Stevens, did you have a question you wanted to get on the record now?
Just a question. We've heard from some districts that they are hiring retired teachers at 24.9% or less, and that's okay under the rules of the retirement system. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Stephen, under the existing rules, a teacher or an administrator is mandated to be in TERS if they have at least a 50% contract. Anything under a 50% contract, they are not eligible to be in TERS. So it does not affect their retirement if they are working under 50%.
Under 50%. Oh, good. Thanks very much.
Which begs the question, if they're not working under 50%, then and it doesn't affect insurance, is there additional cost to the state?
Madam Chair, this is not something that we have analyzed because it happens on an ad hoc basis and we don't know who's hiring because it's not reported to us.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. We did have two districts, I believe, testify they were doing that. With that, I'd like to ask committee members to, if you have concerns, comments, amendments, they're due by noon on Wednesday. So if you could get those to me. On this afternoon's agenda at 1:30, we have SB 157, Microloan Revolving Fund and Loan, SB 186, Voter Registration and PFD Application Registration, possibly SB 216, School Funding for Consolidated Schools, and anything that we might not, if we have anything that's ready to go from legal. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Not, we're adjourned.